But this particular abstract deity was represented by a hierarchy of mandarins, counselors, chancellors, and high officials, all of whom had something to do with the general management of creation. Now, if we see this now, we see the whole thing lying in China itself. China was called the Middle Kingdom. Therefore, the mountain of the gods rose from the center of China. Around it were the provinces, all of the departments and divisions of the Chinese state. And in the universe, these departments, which were merely the amplification of the provinces of China, were assigned to certain deities, so that each province had its guiding spirit, and each community had its ancestral godling or some hero associated with it. Around and on the sides of this great mountain that seemed to rise were the abodes of the immortals. And also, the Chinese recognized five sacred mountains. These five sacred mountains being sacred to the five elements, and also to the division that the Chinese made of the world, which was the four corners and the center. These mountains were all ruled over by deities, and there was a very important god assigned to the great peaks of each of these mountain ranges. And in the highlands of these mountains, up above the clouds, where you could no longer see the world below, were the homes of spirits. The Chinese apparently had a tendency to assign to their demigods some kind of remote earthly habitation. This is a little like the Greeks who chose Mount Olympus for the great judgment hall of their deities. The Chinese did the same thing. Their divinities did not really simply float in the air. They were not totally invisible in the sense that they had no corporeal consideration. They lived some way in the mountains. They had remote places of dwelling. You have the same thing in India, where the rishis and the great immortal mortals, even Shiva himself, may have a habitation among the mighty peaks of Himavat. In the distant mountains, which seem to be enough of a symbol to divide the normal conditions from the mysteries of religion, were therefore an accumulation of immortals. Not just a group of eight with which we are more or less generally familiar, but countless sages, countless wonderful beings, all living in strange places. At one time, one of the great centers was believed to be the Diamond Mountains of Korea. Then there was another great center, more mythological and mysterious, the Jade Mountains, where the highest of the immortals dwelt together in endless bliss. So what the immortals did while they were at home is not quite clear to everyone, but they did have various tasks. They were concerned with the maintenance of forms of life. Some of these immortals are similar in their activities to the nature spirits of medieval Europe, or to the various nymphs and gnomes and dryades of the Greeks and Latins and early Goths. All of these immortals were in some way doing something. One immortal was the one who made the flowers to grow. Another mortal, the immortal, was the one that made the trees to bear their fruit. So without an immortal hovering around, very little worldly accomplishment was possible. There were immortals that whispered into the ears of poets. There were immortals who comforted sick children. There were immortals that walked with the blind so that they would not stumble. There was some god, godling, or saint for every problem that you could possibly imagine. So that the people had a kind of a friendly feeling for these divinities, but as I say, do not seem to have taken them too seriously in common daily worship. The land of the immortals was a very beautiful place, and it was far above any mysterious purgatorial realms below. And according to the Chinese, you really had to be pretty bad not to find some place among the immortals. If your own generation did not honor you, one of your descendants would discover some secret virtue, and you would be elevated to this noble estate. The Chinese did also have records or evidence of re-embodiment. They apparently believed in reincarnation. Not quite in the same way that the Buddhists did, but after Buddhism came in, they accepted it. And most Buddhists and Taoists and many Confucianists today do accept reincarnation. The religion sort of amalgamated, and the three formed the one religion that has descended into modern China. So in the midst of all the world, there was a great mountain that went up almost to the sky. It was so great and so wonderful that human beings could hardly imagine its splendor. Its hallways were of jade. All of the floors were of alabaster. And the roofs and tiles, the ramparts, were of lapis. And all the groynings and all the ponds were of gold. And at the bottom of each pool, the sand was gold and silver. And the flowers all blossomed with diamonds and rubies. It was really an extraordinary place. It was a wonderful world that could have been taken out of the Arabian Nights entertainment. Now, occasionally, mortals, even in this world, were permitted to go to this great palace, the great place on the top of the mountain. And if you want to know how big this palace really was, you must realize that it was 330 miles in circumference, with its ramparts of the most precious metals, and the trees that grew there, that grew leaves of gold and silver themselves, and the little buds that burst open were pearls. Yet all these things were due to the wonderful magic and sorcery of these wonderful magicians, these wonderful spirit god wonder workers that formed this part of the Chinese mythology. So under certain conditions, as we say, a person in the material world might be permitted to go to see what was going on in this world of wonder. And if they were living or born in one of the provinces of China, this great good was to be accorded to them. They might, as they walked along the roads or the pathways to their little homes, suddenly see in the way a tiger standing. Now, this would be a rather frightening experience, but the tiger always spoke very civilly. And the tiger reminded them that he was not really a tiger at all, but that he was the spirit who carried people from the earth to paradise. But as long as they rode on his back, they were perfectly safe. And he invited this selected individual, who, by the way, had been passed and approved by the Lord High Secretary on the top of the mountain. And this person was then allowed to ride on the tiger, and of course, in three bounds, the tiger crossed the surface of the world. He was a really very skillful traveler. And at last they came to the foot of the mountain upon which the palace stood. And here, of course, were the great gods with their heavy swords, their helmets, their wonderful plumed robes hung with feathers. Also, very grim expressions and extraordinary beards. These guards grumbled and mumbled, but when accompanied by the spirit tiger, the visitor was officially permitted to enter. And as the visitor went on and on and on, up through these great staircases toward the top of the mountain, it was just as though he was entering the palace of the emperor in ancient Peking. Each step as he advanced, chamberlains appeared, mandarins with the different colored buttons on their hats, the eight colored robes of those who were the servants of heaven. Little by little he ascended. passing through these wonderful screens of mother of pearl, going over all these doorways and thresholds with floors made of the most precious marble, the most precious stone, with lights of opals and things of this nature. Very festive. And so finally, coming to the great jade staircase, the visitor was allowed to enter into the abode of the great immortals. Now here in the abode of the great immortals, you might meet almost anyone that was important in the great history of Chinese life, culture, and achievement. And according to some legends, you find Jesus there, waiting in his study, regarding the deportment of heaven as he had guarded the virtues of the earth. You might find also all Laozi, but he'd be probably on the opposite side of the palace because he and Confucius never did get along too well. And little things like death do not change such matters. Buddha probably would not be there because he would naturally be assumed to go back to the land of his own origin. But great Chinese Buddhist saints would be there, as old Daruma mumbling and grumbling in his beard. But the great saints of the Huayang or the great school of the void would be there. The Chinese scholars, all of the people who were doing good and doing services to mankind. And you would go still further, perhaps, because you were invited to this special occasion. And you would finally come into the audience chamber of the Queen of Heaven. And this is interesting also because while in the Chinese mythology there was also a King of Heaven, you very seldom hear anything about him. The system was evidently derived from a very ancient matriarchal period in Chinese culture. The King of Heaven was formed of the breath of the eastern air. And he was supposed to be a very wonderful guard and guide to all virtue and good things. He was the master of the I Ching, the classical changes. He was the one who, in some striving way, in some deep, mysterious manner, managed to maintain the equilibrium of the universe. But this process apparently was so arduous that he seldom took part in social activities. The Queen of Heaven, however, was rather a different type. She was supposed to have been the most beautiful mortal who was ever created, because she was mortal originally, and she was fashioned from the breath of the western heaven, and she was completely virtuous, completely beautiful, completely pure in every way. And she was also strangely referred to in symbolism as the Mother of the Tortoise. She was the mother of the golden symbol of eternal life. In her full robes, dignities, and honors, she was usually attended by the phoenix bird as the symbol also of everlastingness. And if you were by some reason or purpose allowed to enter into her presence and make your necessary and proper obeisances to this divine throne, you would find her enthroned upon the throne of the golden phoenix, surrounded by jewels and curtains of silk formed from the very mist of heaven itself. You would be in a vast throne room more magnificent than anything on earth, because if the Chinese liked one thing more than another, it was magnificence. And because most of them hardly had a square meal on earth, magnificence was of great spiritual significance to them. Now, if you were called on to visit this queen upon this day, you might perhaps arrive on the day of her birth, her birthday. Now, unlike ordinary mortals, the Queen of Heaven, or the Queen of the sacred and celestial city, had a birthday only once every 3,000 years. So you had to sort of catch that particular day if you expected to be present. On the calendar up there, the symbol of it all, was measured by the blooming of the peach tree of immortality. This tree, it had new buds every 3,000 years, and this was a very important occasion and constituted one of the Queen's birthdays. After 3,000 years of maturing from the bud, the fruit became ripe, and that was the next occasion of great rejoicing. Because this fruit of the peach of everlastingness was the symbol of the continuing life of all things. And when this time came for the feast of the Queen's birthday, all of the genii, all of the immortals, all of the mysterious sages and saints of the Diamond Mountains and of the Jadestone Peaks, all that belonged to the wise all over the world came there. When China finally discovered there was something outside of China, that there were other countries, the mythology graciously extended to all countries, for it was assumed that in every land there were immortals, that every civilization produced its saints and heroes and sages. And on the great 3,000-year occasion of the birthday of the Queen of Heaven, all of these wise men from everywhere assembled to take place in what one missionary writer said with his tongue in his cheek was the Chinese equivalent of the Eucharist. It was a great ecumenical council in which the wise from everywhere came to share together the fruit of the peach of everlastingness. And there were great processions and great ceremonies. And the Queen of Heaven, with all her retinues, and with all her nobles, and all her assistants and associates, took part in the great banquet. And there were great tables spread out, spread out of the palace. And musicians were called, and sacred dances to perform the ceremonial rites. And all the princes and heroes of the earth who were gathered there were glad to be servants on this great occasion. And so the legends go on of all the magnificence that marked this mysterious journey of a mortal to be present at the feast of the Queen of the Universe. And we'll think this over a little bit and see what we can make out of it, and we may find some rather interesting things. There seems to be no doubt whatever that this legend passed through a number of changes in the descent of things. We know that this Queen of Heaven was made of the air of the West, the winds and vapors that arose in the western corner of the world. And there was a certain mysterious hint here, a certain similarity that we cannot entirely ignore between this whole story and the mysterious accounts of the western paradise of Amitabha Buddha. And it looks as though this was the Chinese version of it. Furthermore, the Queen of Heaven actually comes very close to the Buddhist Kuan Yin. By the time this Bodhisattva, who was male in India and Tibet, and is also sometimes represented as male in Japan, in China became almost completely female. So that the goddess Kuan Yin became, in a sense, the representative and the agent, in fact, was the direct descendant of the Amida Buddha. For the Amida Buddha was the father of Kuan Yin. So the elusive, mysterious, and invisible king of this region might well be the Amida Buddha. And the visible, glorious Queen of Heaven bestowing immortality as she bestowed mercy could also very likely tie into the concept of Kuan Yin, or the goddess of mercy. And in the Western Paradise, you have almost the same story, the jewel trees, the diamond sands, the magnificent buildings, the great temples and shrines, all of the feasting, all of the pools of lotus flowers, everything that you also find in the Chinese account. So what we are probably thinking of is the Western Paradise of Amitabha. And in this Western Paradise also there grew a tree of mysterious benefits to the nations. The tree that was for the healing of the nations, as we find in the book of Revelation. And this tree that bore all manner of fruit. seems to have some relation to this peach tree of eternal life. So what appears to be the meaning behind it all is that there is a universe, we might say, of the quality of karma or Kuan Yin, the universe of eternal compassion. And that the individual who is regarded as worthy to be present in this strange ecumenical congress held on the top of the mountain, the person worthy to be present, journeys into the realms of infinite compassion, infinite beauty, infinite wonder, departing from all worldliness and all contamination and all material things. For all these treasures are, of course, invisible. They are spiritual treasures which are stored up in heaven alone. So the attitude has been to make the treasures of heaven more glorious than anything that could be upon earth. And those who have merited or earned these various good things are supposed to be permitted to feast together in the sacrament of the renewal of their spiritual insight. I think we also have to try to find a little more of the story of the Buddhist principles here. Actually, in the Lotus of the Good Law Sutra, the Buddha himself creates a spectacle out of his own mind that is very close in its absolute grandeur to the concept of the paradise or the marvelous palace of the Queen of the West. This Buddhistic fable causes all the universe to gather around this great mountain upon which the Master is seated on his lotus throne. And the coming of the universe is a spectacle beyond comparison or thought, inasmuch as the beings of 10,000 times 10 million worlds are there. From space, from every direction of the cosmos, from the most remote star, from that which lies beyond all visibility, from times past and for times to come, all beings gather at this great occasion to receive the particular benediction or blessing of the true doctrine. From the Chinese point of view, I think that we have to accept that the peach of immortality, like Jason's golden fleece hanging upon a tree, and many other similar symbols, that the peach of immortality is the Chinese symbol of absolute truth, of universal wisdom, of that which bestows beyond all doubt and beyond all question, the continuance forever of consciousness. The peach, therefore, is more than an alchemical symbolism. It is the symbol, actually, of utter reality itself. It is the symbol of perfection, of the perfect unfoldment of consciousness. Therefore, this peach must naturally and inevitably grow in the human heart. And the marvelous palace and everything that has to do with the ceremony seems to be ritualistic. The queen with her peach tree also appears in the rituals of the Hung Association, indicating that it was intended to be a ritualistic drama. The entire experience, therefore, is the result of merit, of a strange mingling and gathering of things. The Chinese had a little different concept of what constituted merit. They were not quite as severe or as simple in their thinking as the Buddhists of Japan or Korea. To them, merit involved all of the great achievements. It involved not only the dignity and honors and integrities of Confucius, but also the metaphysical insight of Lao Tzu and the eternal patient acceptance of karma, which we find in the doctrine of Buddha. All these things had to be combined in the creation of the Chinese immortal. But as a result of his achieving these things, he attained to the Chinese concept of immortality. The Chinese did not have the idea of the individual disappearing into some kind of a nirvana. This concept did not come to them until after the arrival of Buddhism. Prior to that time, their heaven was more like the heavens of some of the older European nations. It was a place of eternal joy, a place of everlasting happiness. And the symbolism is not too awkward if you begin to try to understand also the Western equivalent of it. In the West, we have always thought of heaven as the place of the rewards of the righteous. Today, if you ask 100 persons who are believers in modern Christian religion just what kind of a heaven they expect to find if they make it, there is going to be some difference of opinion here. Some are going to feel that heaven would not be heaven unless it was a place of happiness, unless the individual was reunited with his loved ones, unless it was the end of pain and sorrow. But very few Orthodox people would think of heaven as the end of themselves. They would consider a place of eternal reward for a minimum of good accomplished by them in this present world. The Chinese follow this very closely. The Buddhists came in and interpreted it for them. The Buddhists came in and explained to them, and the Chinese accepted it also, because again it played back into the three religions. These religions mingled back and forth, each supporting the other in a very strange and sometimes very wonderful way. The Buddha said, yes, this marvelous symbolism of the Queen of Heaven and her wonderful palace is surely only a mental phenomenon. Actually, you don't really believe that there is such a place. It isn't necessary that you believe it that way. Or if you do believe it that way, then it exists only because of your believing. And it is quite conceivable that if all your life you have believed in this kind of a glorious heaven world with jade and opals and wonderful birds singing and flowers and all these ritualistic things, if you believe this and die with this in your consciousness, you will certainly experience it, just as the pressures of the day may result in symbolic dreams. All of the problems of your life while you're here result in a kind of symbolic dreaming after you leave here. And by this symbolic dreaming, you may very well seem to live in this glorious palace with the Queen of the West. But this cannot be a truly real thing. It represents a strange symbolism bearing upon the good results of works. It is merit. It is the fact that you are entitled to a blessed experience. Whereas another person who has lived badly is entitled only to an experience of punishment of some kind. But the blessedness and the punishment both are within the individual. They are the symbols of his own doings and of his own rewards, his merits and his demerits. So it would not be right to assume that these are places, but rather that they are conditions of consciousness. Now to the sage, the Chinese immortals, all of the heroes and the saints and the Rohan of the Chinese Buddhist belief, all of these beings live in the suburbs or on the mountain sides of this immortal mountain, which is the Simiru. They represent, therefore, various degrees of attainment of this quality. They represent the levels by which man ascends. And the place where these different beings dwell represents the level of attainment they have reached. there are those on the lowest level who may be called the immortals. And if we study the immortal very carefully, we realize that all he is really interested in is the extension of his physical life or the survival of his consciousness after death. He merely wants to survive. And in order to survive, he has gained his magical arts and has practiced all of these austerities and severities and has sought himself for the mysterious elixir that is made from cinnabar, the medicine of long life. But what he is trying to do is simply to perpetuate his own consciousness. And to the Buddhist, this would actually be magic. Because magic would be nothing but holding attitudes within yourself by which you perpetuate the existence of yourself. That instead of releasing your consciousness into universality, you are caught with the ego complex. The idea that you must remain you. And to this the Buddhist shakes his head. How can this be true? For you were not you before you came here. You can't remember where you came from, and it is not important to you. Why is it, therefore, so important that you should remember where you go? Is it not more important that there be certain developments of consciousness rather than this link to the perpetuation of the immortal self by magic, which was the action of the immortal? Above the immortal was the hero. And the hero was the one who gained by sacrifice, whose spiritual achievement was not due to some voluntary struggle after immortality, but was due to absolute dedication of life to the service of need. There was no selfishness left in the hero. What do we really have here? We have in the immortals the old arhats of southern Buddhism, the ones who had only one purpose, and that was to achieve salvation for themselves. We have in the heroes, the new order of beings, the arhats of the northern Buddhism, who were no longer concerned with themselves, but sought to attain eternal life through total self-forgetfulness. And in this way, by dedication to the common needs of others, to find that they sometimes would be able to work forever because the need is forever, not because they desire to live forever. The individual must live until the job is done. If that job is human regeneration, must live forever to do it, but without thought of this matter. The third order, therefore, also representing the saints, is again a reference to the completely purified beings. The saints of northern Buddhism would be the bodhisattvas, the emancipated ones, those who had already attained the great enlightenment. And the saints would be the peculiar ministers and servants of the Queen of Heaven, or the mysterious power represented by the guardian of the phoenix. So here we would have an ascending order of human achievement, of man seeking good, of the individual growing through levels of consciousness to reach finally the Western paradise of Amitabha. This Western paradise being the place of endless peace and joy, the place of complete and utter reward. This abode was copied from the mysterious palace of Indra in Indian mythology. Indra being a kind of god of the world and of the air. This deity represented the ruler of the temporal state of things. And therefore his palace was the best and noblest part of creation. It could not go beyond creation itself into the uncreated. It was the terrestrial paradiso of Dante. It was the paradise of the Christian as distinguished from heaven. The paradise being the place of the reward of virtue. In Buddhism, paradise is a state of consciousness, just exactly as the temple and the palace of the queen were states of consciousness. Paradise is the state of complete inner serenity. It is the state internally of complete and perfect faith in the reality of things. It is life without doubt, life without fear, without danger of contamination. Life in which the individual is so completely established in the laws of things that the fulfillment of virtue is no difficulty. That is the natural and graciousness of its own quality manifesting in living. The person then, the symbol of the arhat in paradise, simply means the bliss of complete enlightenment. The bliss of the full resurrection of the person from the darkness and death of his own doubts. The complete internal acceptance of the law. In the paradise, there is no longer any conflict between the universal plan and the individual. And as a result of this, he experiences the universe as eternally benevolent. As long as he never crosses the universe, never goes against it, he will never suffer from it. There is a little fable in Buddhism bearing on this that is rather interesting, in which the Buddha was accused of being a controversialist, that he was accused of attacking the opinions of other people. And he gives the little story very simply. He said, if you show me an object and ask me the color of it, and that object is white, I will tell you it is white. But to the man who is ignorant, that thing which is white may appear to be black. And if I tell him that the thing that he thinks is black is truly white, then he will claim that I am arguing with him. He will not accept, but he will not be able to realize that I have properly named it. Therefore, he will regard the Buddha as a controversialist. This is the same type of thing that is carried in the Chinese thought. We have here the universe of jade and lapis, of jewels and of wonders. This is just the universe as it is. This palace of the Queen of the West is creation, as it truly is, in the midst of which grows the mystery of the Tree of Life, the same as in the story of Eden. This palace is the universe experienced by the just man. To the materialist, the universe is just space and stars. To the evil man, the universe is simply pain. To the ignorant man, the universe is simply mystery. But to the purely and truly enlightened man, the universe is infinite beauty, infinite truth, infinite wisdom and infinite love. And this wonderful universe as it really is, to be experienced only by the individual who is capable of inwardly perceiving and knowing this universe. This is the marvelous palace of the Queen of Heaven. It is the world we do not know, because in our own consciousness we are not capable of experiencing it. In order that we may have this experience, we must be carried there by the peculiar and wonderful messenger of the deities, which in China is usually represented as a tiger. Not because the tiger is particularly sacred to the Chinese people, it is the symbol of heroism. But because in the mystery rituals, the tiger has another meaning. The tiger belongs to the cat family, and the feline is the kind, or is the tribe, that sees in the dark. It is able to see through and in the darkness. Therefore, it is the animal that was assumed to be able to find its way back again to the realm of reality after it had been sent out of that realm into worldliness. To come down into worldliness to pick up a passenger, so to say, the tiger had to know how to find its way back. And the symbol of the tiger was the all-seeing eye in darkness and absolute courage against obstacles. These were the two powers that enabled this symbolic being to find its way home. And in returning home, to carry with it the destined person. Now, the destined person is the one whom the great recorders and the Lord High Secretaries and the Lord High Chamberlains and the Lord High Administrators have discovered from the Book of Fates to be ready to receive enlightenment. Therefore, in a sense, all these judges, all this vast paraphernalia of the Queen of Heaven simply represents the laws of karma. And if we see this, then some of these rather grotesque and unpleasant augustnesses suddenly become understandable to us. They represent the interesting, remarkable, and intricate patterning of karma. They are, in a way, are the destiny keepers of everything. The God who lives under the hearthstone, the God who lives in the kitchen, the God who hides behind the door, the God of the street, of the plagues, the God of insects and beasts and of birds, the gods of the living and of the dead, are all the ones who administer the fates of things. And these fates are karma. Consequently, every man's karma has an appearance. And most people find their karma a little on the grotesque side when they try to live with it. They find it difficult and terrible. But when the time comes and the great Lord of accountants and assessors have decided that a soul wandering in the lower world has, by the great edicts, by the great books, by the way of heaven, is entitled to be received into the abode of the enlightened, we have nothing more or less than a statement that karma has brought to the individual illumination. It has brought this person to the point where the lords of justice, the great judges, the administrators, may say fully and honestly, this soul deserves this. So the laws become these administrators, and they send their messenger to bring the soul to the feast of the Queen of the West. This is exactly the same legend we have in the Troubadours and in the Alchemists. The Queen of Heaven is the blessed damozel that we find in the poems of Dante Gabriel Rossetti. But the entire symbolism is the same, because it represents in every instance the Queen of the laws of existence, the great powers which administer the karmic responsibilities of life. So having received the invitation to enter into this magic garden of consciousness, karma having moved the individual to a state of enlightenment within himself, he experiences the unfolding of his own inner universe, and by the parallel suddenly perceives the magnificent unfolding of the larger universe around him. He discovers that his own eyes being opened, that he can see this mountain that rises in the middle of the earth, that he can see the great palace upon its summit. Not because these things have a physical reality or a literal reality, but because they become symbols of the great qualities that sustain existence. The discovery of the great palace of the sovereigns of the world simply means that man has discovered the universe to be the house of a living God. The universe itself is the great palace. Its roof, its walls of jewels and gems, and its magnificent canopy of stars and shining lights. But to the person who is not so enlightened, this universe is a dull and tragic place. So it is according to the initiation ritual, that the candidate, advancing by 3 degrees, is finally brought into the presence of the Queen of Heaven, who in this case is the goddess Isis, the mysterious mother of mysteries, the wonderful symbol of truth as forever bearing the saviors of the world, of eternal light, ever fruitful of good, and the eternal benevolent fruitfulness of existence on the basis that the universe is the temple that is forever bearing fruit, forever causing to come forth life. And the mystery of wisdom, the sanctuary, the temple, the inner soul of man, guards very cautiously and wisely the peach of everlastingness. We can take the symbolism, and by it we can do something that has not generally been possible in Chinese mythology. If you break down into these patterns, you can then become aware, at least in part, of a system. A system the Chinese probably do not know very much about themselves. A system that has never been translated into English. A system that has only been ridiculed by missionaries, simply because you must really know it in order to find it. You must recognize the inevitability of it before you can discover it. It has to be this way, however, factually. It had not been this way, Buddhism would have changed this pattern at an early date. It had to be that the blending or the partnership between Taoism and Buddhism meant that the mysterious alchemical mystery world of Taoism, with all its palaces and its marvelous jeweled temples, had to be paralleled with and made identical with the Western paradise of Amitabha. It was then possible for these two to be interchangeable values, for the Taoist to be a Buddhist and the Buddhist to be a Taoist without conflict, because they were both then talking of the same thing, the mysterious palace of eternal light, which is experienced by man in his own soul and then discovered by him throughout the universe. By this parallel and this partnership, we can justify a reunion between the old Indian philosophy that Lao Tzu contacted, and the return of Indian thought to China through Buddhism nearly 500 years later. Here we make a pattern, and in the presence of this pattern, Confucianism stands at one side like one of the High Lord counselors, and Confucianism has its little part also, because when the books are balanced, when the judges have produced their records, when all has been weighed, when in solemn conference the counselors have come to verdict, this verdict is based upon the absolute integrity of the evolving being to whom these decisions apply. Therefore, Confucianism cannot depart from the idea that it is the person who lives according to the laws of the superior being, dedicated, honorable, unquestioned in integrity, preserving all the rights and statutes. This person is the type of person to whom these other experiences can happen. So Buddhism accepted the moral code of Confucius and made it a requisite for the attainment of the Western paradise. Altogether, it fitted into one pattern. But this pattern cannot be explained unless the gods of China are the great principles of universal existence, and that the orders of secondary gods, the guardians, the tutelaries, the family gods, and all these represent the administrations of universal law, especially karma. That the so-called worship of ancestors, which was also carried into Japan under Buddhism, signifies man's recognition that the ancestral pattern in himself is the basis of a high standard of integrity if he will live it. And that the ancestral souls moving in and out of life fulfill the law of rebirth. Altogether, we can make a good picture out of it. And while it is hard now, we know that the Buddhist scholars in the first century A.D. were much closer to the pattern. They knew the Chinese language, which they mastered, and were able to translate their own scriptures into Chinese. Among the Chinese, a number of great teachers, both Taoistic and Buddhistic, arose to bind these patterns together. And we have to realize that the Western paradise became the symbol of the universe seen through the eyes of the illumined person. Therefore, there is the proper spectacle of the great wonder of the universal law, the great plan, the radiant assembly of sages. And consequently, it becomes something for us all to aspire to, inasmuch as if illumination comes, the universe will change in its appearance from matter to magic, from magic to sublimity, until finally it is completely possessed or ensouled by the magnificent purpose for which it exists. When we have all these experiences, then in a strange way, we experience our place as an immortal in an immortal plan. And we think this through, I think we get a little something out of the Chinese mythology, which, as we said, is a very difficult subject. Well, thank you very kindly.